Blog Talk Radio.
It's great to be here with you. I've been struck over the past week with this what seems to be a bit of a struggle. You know, we have different struggles in the craft. We always have, but this one is a matter of realizing that, you know, if we take a look at our history, many of the struggles that we are experiencing today were with us hundreds of years ago. It makes me think that they are an essential part of the process of becoming, the process of awareness. It's a dynamic. It's a tension as if, you know, the laws of the universe are impacting us without us being able to see that law, to see that force in action, or to wonder surrounding us are forces that are competing, that hold us in this perfect balance, and that it includes our thinking. What if that were the case? If that were the case, I'd like to ask you to consider what else would we be troubled by? What else would grab our attention? Are we so, addicted to this notion? Do we crave this notion of tensions and this sense of our work being to resolve those tensions that we can never see, that we can't see it any other way? I tend to think that we can. What if, then, we accept that these dynamics are beyond our control? They're part of the universe, infinite, which we ought to come back and talk about. What if those things are necessary, not something to defeat, not something that we will resolve so that our selection, our thinking will prevail over all other forces? If we did that, if we were able to, even intellectually, if we think about it, if we're able to remove, for whatever reason, one of the forces that hold us in this incredible sequence, wouldn't that put everything else out of balance? Wouldn't it? I can find the examples that I use for this. You know, I don't know enough physics. I know enough to be dangerous about my understanding of physics. But where I break it down is, you know, our husbandry, animal husbandry, the way we handle our environment. If we do things that are toxic to our environment, we can change our environment. In a sense, we can kill the environment. And when we destroy one part of it, for whatever reason, it creates imbalance in other aspects. This careful and perfect balance of forces is thrown under the bus. And then what is it? What do we experience? Well, it really becomes a roll of the dice after that, until we can put our best minds to the task of helping us to calculate the consequences of our actions. That's what environmentalists have been doing. And, you know, if you extrapolate again, environmentalists have been doing that for a long, long time. And I'm not just saying the brilliant scientists that we have today, but old farmers have been looking at this question for a long, long time. And they've realized you don't put manure in your streams and expect that every animal that drinks from it or the fish that live in it are going to be healthy. They know that. And to suggest that everybody clamoring to make profit is irresponsible, unthinking part of the problem. Well, good luck with that. How masonry alludes to this in a way. It's so damn versatile, isn't it? It alludes to these notions of balance. So today I want to talk with you. The program will I think, pivot if I'm very, very fortunate. The program will pivot around the questions of balance. I don't mean to suggest that your way of thinking is in any way wrong, or what I'm saying here is, you know, perfection. That's certainly not the case. But think about if we're experiencing consequences, decisions that were made by other people, and really is almost irrelevant. The consequences are in place, and we are living with them. What to do? Well, a very brilliant old woman once told me, and she was quoting, of course, when you don't know what to do, do nothing. So until we understand what in the world is going on around us, we need to be observers. We need to use this time to absorb data or facts or consistencies and look for patterns. And we can do that. It's not easy, mind you, but we can do that. And you listeners will have their own examples of this, I'm sure. Where does that take us? It takes us to, it puts us into a stream of thinkers that are looking for first principle, looking for, you know, epistemology, looking for the answer, looking for truths. I can clamor for that and say, you know, I like the challenge of living and chasing, in a sense, the truth, living with that. And it's not just but I realize it's not just a throwaway that I can say to you and not accept that as part of my, you know, my function, my moral core in what I do. I change. And sometimes I'm more distracted by things than others. Sometimes my recall of all of this, the context changes. And I'll admit that if you're expecting that I have this mechanistic uniformity, I do, where, you know, I have a formula in a sense. You know, it's like the notes on a keyboard or a fretboard. You know, they are where they are. But I can, you know, adjust the tone of the strings so that they aren't where they are. But there is this openness, this this effect that I think I'm trying to get at with you. The effect is, if we surround ourselves with certain things, we know that we will have a tendency, not a cause and effect, but a tendency that can produce some very remarkable, very satisfying outcomes with people. Masonry, it does that. Now, didn't mean to make that quite as obscure as it did. I tend to do that, as you know. But if, for example, you know, every program, we stop and include poetry. There's a reason, and it's not to upset anyone. Of course not. But the reason is that by leaning into leaning into poetry, it does something to us. And I'll talk about this later. It listening to poetry, like why care? Who cares? You know, you have no history of it. You've been taught by very unimaginative, uninspired teachers. Okay, so they tell us that they're very excellent. They're all very hardworking, and I'm sure they are. But at a certain point, we realize that where we are, our status has less to do with their meagerness, the mediocrity, than our own drive to overcome those, whatever barrier, we overcome it. But poetry, there's a genius to poetry. Every word in a poem has a meaning. Now, draw the parallels with our order. Hmm? Regardless of whether a poem is a sonnet or a villanelle or free verse, it's the most condensed form of language. The sum of the words creates an emotional response for the audience. That's the genius of poetry. Do you get it? Well, to listen to somebody criticize the art form because they don't understand it is just that person demonstrating the lack of understanding. That's perfectly, am I going to stop that? No. Would I? No. It's the people, it's wondering what do all these people through history, what was it that was the appeal? Oh, I know, I'm brilliant in every way, and the light of enlightenment shines out of my orifices. You know, of course, I have untamed ego, so I don't. But and I know better than everybody, and I know better than history, and blah blah blah. Tedious, yeah? You've heard it before. Just boring as hell. But curious, why is this? When I looked at the perfect, you know, definitions of perfect art form, I see opera, and I think, why would these learned bodies be suggesting and describing, you know, the perfect art form? Like, isn't that how difficult are they? How pretentious? How elitist are they? And when I get away from all those value judgments, my value judgments, I'm left with the question, what's the big deal? What's the appeal? And when I look into it, well, you know, am I able to figure this out? Well, I certainly aren't. I'm not going to figure anything out unless I try to do it. Take it a bit seriously for me, for my own sake. So I'm curious about why is that important? And the search, and then why? What are they saying? What are the academics? What are the people that study this? The experts, and the experts do exist in the world in all kinds of things. What do they explain? How do they explain this? And when I listen to the explanations, then I can get to judge for myself, can't I? I can make the judgment. Oh, I could be swayed by all that the opinion. Think, well, those are very intelligent people. So if they think X, Y, and Z, then I should think X, Y, and Z. There's only one area where I've ever felt that, and I'll admit that openly. I realized a long, long time ago that most of the greatest minds evidenced around the world were people devout. Were people devout. They had a devotion. They had a respect for a higher power, for not somebody that it was a, you know, a personal argument, or not proselytizing, but they have the sense of the universe and trying to make sense out of the order that you find, and wondering is that the source, is that the creative, and so I thought if all these people over, you know, throughout history were devout, what was the draw? What was it that appeals to that level of intelligence? Now, I'm not suggesting that if I found the bespoke suit that all of the genius in the world wore, that would make me a genius. Yeah, no, I'm not that stupid. I'm thinking the influence. What did they know that I didn't, that I don't? A lot of things in my life occur like that. What if, and what can I understand, and what influence does it have? Well, I'll let you know when I figure that out, gentlemen, brethren. But in the meantime, it's interesting because over the years, I've become less judgmental about these things. There's less in my sense of taste. You know, I have, just like you, I have my own taste in music and the arts. But it seems to me to be expanding, to be broadening. And I think because unlike you, I only have one shot at this, I think, this sense of consciousness and reason. I'm curious to see what effect this will have as I go through life. Better or best, I'll leave that to you. I've lost the ability to tell you or anybody else right from wrong. I've seen a little more than perhaps some people, less than others. But I do have a sense of a respect for sincerity, a respect for authenticity. And when people, when I'm learning about these influences that I noticed through history, the people that are talking to me speak with that authority. They're not making it up. They're not trying to twist my arm or sell me something. This isn't snake oil. They're sharing, and it's an exchange of idea. And it's left to me to discover the influences within myself. Why would I, here's my simplistic thinking. Why would I walk through go to an art gallery. Why would I walk through an art gallery? And then in my own mind, be sulking and be cynical about every form of art in the room. Why would I do that? I can't imagine. I can't imagine. Why would I? But then, you know, you see the children being taken through. You see the partners being dragged by their partner, completely oblivious to, you know, just it's painful. They just want to, they're enduring it. Let's get this over with. They're chatting away, or they have their cell phone on. And then you see some people sitting, or just sitting still and absorbing. You wonder, what is that? What is that? And after a while, you stop asking, what is that? You have it. We have it. It comes to you. At least it came to me. People have noticed something. Is it composition? Is it a story that's being told? Is it the use the brushstroke, or all of it? Is it the uniqueness of the artist's expression of what is or what could be, or all of it? Poetry, and I think there's a parallel here. You can tell I'm building up to the big finale here. The poetry helps us to listen closely. Aude him. You think about Aude, vide, ace. Aude, listen, vide, watch, tace, in silence. Poetry, it inspires. It inspires if you can connect with it. The poems tug at us, at our emotion. It's like when I hear Nosem Dorme sung, you know, I will be victorious. She will not learn my name and put me to death. You know, it there's an emotion, and it breaks our, sometimes it breaks our hearts, because that makes us feel alive. You know, some poems speak to a man or woman to us that have a sense of the bittersweetness of life. The black and white, or as one fellow that I know talks about being binary, may not talk about the bittersweetness of life, but they will experience it. The poems, they confirm, and Masonry is masonry. Masonry confirms the human experience. And by reading, poetry makes us less alone and makes us feel, it gives feel more alive. Attention to detail. So do we benefit from it? I think there's a parallel. Why would a brother be studying? Because it enhances all these things. It encourages us to listen and pay attention. And that's not a bad thing, I think. Here, we have a good program for you today. The poetry, 16th century, the fellow that is accredited with writing the first sonnets in English, William Wyatt. Oh, and the music. Well, this is an unusual piece for us. This is from Louisiana Repertory Jazz Ensemble. It's sorrowful. It's sorrowful. Sit back and relax. Let us try and inform and entertain. That'll do. That'll do nicely. Huh. Nice way to start a program, eh? Here, we continue the theme that you search for understanding, whether it's your need or whether it's something you do every day, you want to be reminded of every day. Being is a room, being in a room of strangers is one thing. Being in a room of brethren is another. I'm inclined to think those who are on the outside looking in are those who haven't been told the story of how masonry was built on mutual trust, created by a tale of one person, Hiram. This story includes the way he found to communicate with men of all languages and cultures. How? Symbolically. The metaphor, the allegory, that meant it would appeal to a certain type of man. Knowing ambition was not limited to religion, business, or politics, human values were added. And so it went until we began tinkering with the model, as groups of men always tend to do. If this is good, what if we made a change? Could it get better? The success of this model comes to us by its endurance over a long period of time in human years. The influences that launched masonry were, to my mind, two layers. One, the values aiming at a virtuous life. We could trace that back to Socrates. Don't believe it. Argue with him. Infrastructure needing to launch the idea, leading to launch this idea, required legitimacy. We were building infrastructure. You know, we make yourselves part of that group. Knowing that in history, somebody would say, well, if we do it, if we meet in that city on this date, then eventually we'll be credited with all of these ideas and all this history that predates it. And we've done that pretty much. But even now, our history is being made more and more accurate each year. So we know that's a pin. We're putting a pin in the map. But we notice there are other pins in that map that predate this by hundreds of years. And then it makes us think about the infinite qualities of masonry. It wasn't just those four, you know, some simple lodges. And even it's the illusion that all these lodges were turned out and they had this grand, you know, this is the Nicene group again. Well, it wasn't like that. No. This is some very brilliant. They're very thoughtful and, you know, great thinkers. They came together and they had the resources and they knew how to use them. So, but it needed to kickstart this. It required legitimacy, and that required who? Montague. And a history was created. We need a history for validation. Well, we know that that old is equated with legitimate. So we can make up that story. If we make up that story that our upstart is actually very, very old, then it gives us an opportunity to feel and that we are legitimate, and that will appeal to other people. So we did create, and so those histories are not necessarily factual, but they're legend, and they convey their vehicles for information, for ideas. A legend was written, and the presence of cultural legitimacy were introduced to enhancements, adventurers, scientists, philosophers, artists, writers, the kind of things that define entire cultures over time, all can be traced back to the faith those men had in their discovery. I suggest none of this would be possible without their trust in one another. Today, we find that same connection is possible. The effect of oral history, building undying trust, is within our grasp, within each of us. That's Clark Terry from a show he did in Germany, Brockhausen in 2000. That's one. Fancy. Here. Thomas Wyatt, the poet that we'll share today. It's not the most ancient poem that I think we've done things by Homer here years ago. This is a fellow that was born in England, 1503 in Allington. It's near Kent for those of you who know that map. He was a poet who introduced the Italian sonnet and turns that rime of verse form and the French rondeau into English literature. And I guess there weren't any other schools. Everybody was going to Cambridge or Oxford. They were old. Cambridge was over 1,000 years old. But he was educated there, and he became a member of the court circle of Henry VIII. So the legacy, what's left to us, this isn't the street poets like the rappers that we have today, you know, just this proliferation around us is brilliant. No, because these people had connections and because they had credentials that we know about them. Wyatt's fortunes at court fluctuated, but he had an association with the Boleyn family. And it's thought that he had an affair with Anne Boleyn, who we will know in the context of Henry VIII. And it likely contributed to his first arrest. He was imprisoned in 1536, and he was arrested again in 1541 after the execution of his ally, Thomas Cromwell. Yeah, that Thomas Cromwell. During his career, he served a number of diplomatic missions, and he was knighted in 1537. You know, such is the vagaries of life, eh? You're in prison one day and you're a knight the next. But his fame rests chiefly on his poetic achievements. Now, I'm picking this up from Britannica. I love the source, the authenticity and the accuracy of it. So he has a number of pieces, and today I've selected just one of them. If you're thinking about somebody impacting Western literature, huh? Here, we have it. this is who's so list to hunt. It was written in the 1530s or 40s as one of the first sonnets written in English. And it concentrates on the theme of love as a despairing and vicious pursuit. And the poem, this is from resources tuition courses, this analysis. More specifically, the poem presents the failed hunt of a woman who is loved by another man. Then we think in the background, this is about Anne Boleyn. The poem's form is significant because it was the first of its kind. The sonnet began as a form of a song, and thanks to Francesco Petrarch, became one of the most widely used forms of poetry across Europe in the 14th and 16th centuries. Well, of course it did. The poem's author, Sir Thomas Wyatt, introduced the romantic sonnet form to the English readership. And he uses conceit, an extended metaphor in which the sport of hunting for a deer is likened to courting an unattainable woman. And here, see if you find these things as we go through it. The poem opens with the sentence, "Whoso list to hunt, I know where is an hind, but as for me, alas, I may no more." The voice is immediately established as in the first person. And the speaker says that if anyone is looking for a place to hunt, they know where to find deer. But unfortunately, the speaker himself cannot keep hunting. This creates an expectation as the reader listens for an explanation as to why the speaker can no longer hunt. The metaphor of the deer is continued through the poem, and the speaker describes how even when he follows the deer both with his mind and physically, she runs away. "May yet I by no means be wearied, mind, draw from the deer as she fleeth afore, fainting I follow." The deer, or the woman, is personified as the wind, depicting the woman's evasive nature. The speaker is unable to catch her and keep her for himself. But this metaphor here is potentially problematic in the way it negotiates gender roles. The male speaker is the hunter with a net who tracks down the innocent female who has no means of protecting herself except in her ability to flee like a vulnerable deer, most often associated with being the hopeless victim in the chase of such a hunt. See if you see it. The poem can be split into three sections, the octave, the first eight lines, and the volte, and the sestet, the last six lines, where the speaker explains his warning and the female voice overpowers the original speaker. "Whoso list to hunt, I know where is an hind, but for me, alas, I may no more. The vain travail hath wearied me so sore, I am of them that furthest cometh behind. Yet may I by no means be wearied mind, draw from that deer, but as she fleeth for, fainting I follow. I leave off, therefore, sithens in a net I seek to hold the wind. Who list her hunt, I put him out of doubt. As well, I may spend his time in vain. Engraven with diamonds and letters plain, there is written her fair neck round about. Noli mi tangere, for Caesar's I am, and wild for to hold, though I seem tame. If anyone wants to go hunting, I know where you can find a deer." Thomas Wyatt, 16th century. Made you look. Here, Ben Webster. Ben Webster, Stardust, just lovely, just lovely, lovely. Here, help me with this. History, huh? We've been looking at masonry from a distance. The effects, the away from London, from the the porches of equally cosmopolitan center in the Netherlands. For historically, a military might, a trade hub, an influence. Here we've been reading about that, and during the period of the 1780s, what effects can we find? It's to suggest that the effects may still be lingering if you see them, and those effects may still be prevalent and influential, and we ought to understand that. But even before the 1780s, Masonic rhetoric gloried in republics. Wasn't focused on, all hail the king and queen. It was about the republics, and we can think about that, in terms of the continental Freemasonry and possibly a reflection on his English and Scottish origins. You know, that fight that the battle for legitimacy. And among the most frequently cited Masonic heroes is the ancient Greek legislator Lycurgus. He was a lawgiver in Spartan, and he's credited with establishing the military-oriented reformation of Spartan society. A king of Sparta? Yeah. So traditionally, the lawgiver who founded most of the institutions in ancient Sparta, this is this guy. In the 1780s, the Grand Lodge of Austria went even further and claimed that every lodge is a democracy. Every lodge is a democracy. German Freemasons of the same period identified, in quotes, our freedom as the tradition of the British nation. Danish Freemasons of the 1760s praised the condition of republican freedom as a great good. And of course, there was the myth of Cromwell, which never went away. Masonic propagandists as late as 1776 were claiming Cromwell formed the order, founded the order. But that, they were not Republicans, nor was there anything revolutin about this society. In 1779, the most intellectual lodge in Paris, the Nine Muses, or Sisters, entertained Benjamin Franklin, lavishly praising his virtues. It also described its members as citizens of the Masonic democracy. By the 1780s, the Proceedings of the Nine Muses were printed far and wide in Masonic almanacs. In a French language almanac emanating from The Hague in 1784, the discourse included is openly political. Speaker probably the Count, Italian Count of Medini, a translator of Voltaire, says that he has been all over Europe to Belgium, Germany, and France, always enlightened by new lights. He has discovered that everyone is interested in Freemasonry. Only in Masonry does the distance which nobility and civil titles give to an individual disappear. The unity of Masonry gives it a solidity that even the Roman Republic did not have. Hear, hear. The enlightenment he has found in his travels tells him to regard with a philosophical eye all the revolutions in states. I find they are in the natural order of things. Their causes lie in the legislation, the government, the genius, mores and passions of a nation. And Freemasonry sought to address all those aspects of the human condition. And by the 1780s, Masonic speeches in some quarters of Western Europe directly reflect a profound political discontent. By the 1790s in Germany, we can find Masonic literature that openly spoke the language of the French Revolution and violently condemned despotism and slavery. Alongside a republic as the ideal, Freemasons most frequently cited England by name as the country worthy of emulation. Anglophilia naturally accompanied these political sentiments and readily found among French Freemasons even after the American War for Independence, in which France had been an ally of the colonialists. In the French lodges of 1780s, we can hear the orator proclaim, "The country of Europe that is regarded by almost everyone as the most wise, England, seems to possess the true and unique religion." That's us. French Freemasons publicly longed for the same honor and distinction accorded the order there. Regularly, brothers were told in their almanacs, among other sources, that the general principles of Masonic government come from England. It possesses the First National Grand Lodge, as well as a system of nominations and elections, which all provincial lodges now follow, within the limits of the political government of their respective states. At all times, within Freemasonry, authority must descend from the Grand Lodge of a nation, even if the prince is the head of a lodge. The other prerogative of the legally constituted lodges is liberty. That'll do. Well, there we have it. Have I convinced you about the influences? Have I been that persuasive? You think those influences of, what do we cross here? Poetry of 16th century, the political and intellectual growth of 17th century, 18th century, do you think those values, those influences are still with us? I do, as you can tell. And then what? Well, then what is where we go along different paths according to our taste. You and I walk into the library and one book attracts you, one title attracts me. And we pursue them, and the beauty is when, like as I did just yesterday, again, I have had a chance to sit down with a very learned brother, who taught me his perspective. He was sharing perspective. When Masons do that around me, I believe it brings out the best in me, and for that, I'm eternally grateful. And I feel indebted. It's my responsibility to do the same, to present myself and meet those expectations, to bring out the best in him. It's not piety that we're looking for. It's simply understanding. Simple as that is, the search, and it goes on and on. It doesn't. It is infinite. So maybe I'll change the name of the show from Masonic Effects to Infinite Masonic Effects. Maybe I kind of like that. We'll pick that theme up again. And thank you very much for sitting in. You folks in Ireland, I very much appreciate your attention to the show. I'm glad that you're with me. You're following it. I appreciate that. And Japan, I think there's a message. I think Masonic Effects hold some value to and blends well with the kind of order and grace that what little I know of the Japanese culture is able to bring to the world. And very, very incredible influence, I think. In Turkey and Pakistan, this is not, while much is made about, turmoil, it just deflects from the clarity, the contributions to science and the arts made by these nation states over the years, and still a significant part of world history. The African continent is dotted. There's nations dotted and scattered that are tuning into Masonic Effects. Now it grabs my imagination as much, and I'll be very honest with you, as much as the listeners from China and from Russia. Now, they may have nefarious goals in mind. I tend to think that there are brethren there reaching out, and by whatever happenstance, they have found us and we have found them. No need to insult the values of any nation. No, this is to those listeners as it is to listeners in Britain and North America. The enhancement, it's the enhancement of values that are needed in a world of cynicism. The correctness, I'll leave that to you. The right, I'll leave that to you. This isn't a gamesmanship. This is more, being who you really are, caring about other people, that kind of stuff. I hope you'll tune in next week. We have a good program for you. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you again. Next time it's your round.